So in this series, we are looking at a number of imperfect, or I think in the case of the story today, more accurately, unlikely heroes. So what time period are we looking at in the Bible? Most of the characters are from the book of Judges, which comes after the death of Joshua, who had led the Israelites into the Promised Land, and before the series of kings, beginning in Samuel. The nation is led by a series of rulers, and as Claire said in her introduction, the stories of these judges are bold, brutal, and often challenging. In fact, I should give a bit of a warning about the story today, because it includes some fairly hefty violence. The message introduction to Judges reads, "Sex, violence, rape, and massacre, brutality and deceit do not seem to be congenial materials for use in developing a story of salvation. Given the Bible's subject matter, God and salvation, living well and loving deeply, we quite naturally expect to find in its pages leaders for us who are good, noble, honourable men and women showing us the way. So it is always something of a shock to enter the pages of the book of Judges and find ourselves in nearly unrelieved mayhem. God, it turns out, does not require good people in order to do good work. He can and does work with us in whatever moral and spiritual condition he finds us. God, we are learning, does some of his best work using the most unlikely people. Twice in Judges, there is the telling refrain, at that time, there was no king in Israel. People did whatever they felt like doing, but we readers know there was a king in Israel. God was king. And so, while the lack of earthly king accounts for the moral and political anarchy, the presence of a sovereign God, however, obscurely realised, means that the reality of the kingdom is never in doubt. How reassuring, hey, sometimes in the present climate, where we may not understand why we have the leaders that we do, there is the presence of a sovereign God, which means that the reality of the kingdom, God's kingdom, is never in doubt. So Judges is known for its kind of Groundhog Day type of story. God's people are constantly going off on their own and are not being loyal to God. They then suffer and cry out to God, and God is constantly rescuing them despite their repeated failures to keep their covenant with him. And in this book, we learn about 12 judges, including Deborah, who we're talking about today, Gideon and Samson, who we'll have talks about in the next few weeks. And when reading about judges, I found out that judge does not necessarily mean a judicial official, i.e. kind of somebody with a wig in a court of law, but rather these people were military leaders and clan chieftains. And these judges, these people, weren't rulers over the whole of Israel, but only certain tribes. And there was sometimes a tension between the different tribes. One or several of the tribes may have been attacked by their enemies, but not all of the tribes would come to their aid, and not all were united. So there was a lot of political intrigue at the time. And the basic problem that sets the tone in Judges is set out in the beginning couple of chapters of Judges. God had asked the Israelites to destroy the Canaanites when they took over the Promised Land, but they kind of ignored that command and failed to destroy them. So essentially they were disobedient, and God leaves the Canaanites in the land as a thorn in Israel's side. He says they will be a snare to them. However, despite the ups and downs, God's care for his people holds all the stories together. And so to the story of today, the story of Deborah. And in this particular case, the Israelites were being oppressed by King Jabin and his army commander, Sisera. Jabin had a formidable force of 900 iron chariots. So this was kind of top of the range military gear in that era. And the Israelites had been cruelly oppressed for 20 years. When they go into battle with King Jabin, we get the detail in chapter 5 that God caused a flood The earth quaked, yes, the skies poured rain. Oh, the clouds made rivers. So this meant that all the chariots got stuck in the mud and so couldn't be used. How amazing is that? The troops scatter and Sisera, the army commander, runs for his life into the tent of Jael, wife of Heber, thinking it was a safe place. Sisera asks for some water and Jael cracks open a skin of goat's milk to give him. But as you will have heard, this is not the only thing that she cracks open that day. She gives him milk, which I guess, you know, can make you sleepy, and then gets a tent peg. And this wouldn't have been any ordinary tent peg that we use kind of for our church camps. Tents in those days would have been 50 foot long and 20 foot wide. So this would be quite a big tent peg. And it's pretty gory, really, isn't it, what happens next? And once Sisera had been killed, the corner is turned in the battle and the Israelites press harder until later they end up getting rid of King Jabin also. And it says at the end of chapter 5 that there was then peace for 40 years. And the intrigue of the story of Deborah in this bit of the Bible is that it involves two women, Deborah and Jael, who kind of overshadow the actual deliverer, Barak. I, of course, love the fact that there is a strong woman leader in this Old Testament story. Not only a woman, but a woman who is a wife, probably a mother with a family, who is leading at a high level and with real impact. She obviously won't have been perfect, and all leaders in the Bible are imperfect and point towards the only truly perfect leader, that is Jesus. However, I think she was quite cool, really, a bit of a legend, in fact. A prophet, a political leader, strategist, a creative, a songwriter, worship leader, wife. Now, I'm not a fantastic historian, but it's probably quite surprising at that time to find such an influential female leader. And there is a lesson in there about perhaps ruling ourselves out of leadership because of circumstances. Kind of, you know, sorry, I have a family, sorry, I'm married, I'm too old, too young. And those excuses don't seem to work in God's economy. Prostitutes, adulterers, drunks, murderers, teenagers, widows, childless octogenarians, they are all used in leadership in the Bible. So let not your circumstances rule you out or rule out God's ability to use you. When I look back to when we were asked to think about joining the leadership team, which is kind of coming up to 5 years ago, Thea, our third child, was a couple of months old. Jacob was a preschooler and Roger was living in London 3 days a week. And that year, in fact, proved to be one of the hardest in my life, as my wonderful father went from being a well man to very unwell, and he died in December that year. So it possibly wasn't the ideal background time in life to step into leadership in a church, and I still feel pretty inexperienced. I've got no theological training. But before we sort of went and had that meal with Tom and Sarah where they asked us what we thought about it, I'd kind of prepped Rog because I sort of knew that it was coming up. And we'd had this fantastic training at our church in London and an experience of being involved in a church plant. And when we were asked, we responded to the call to step up. And I think looking back on those 5 years and the role, it's been one of blessing. We've been able to learn from others on the team and from Rick, who is a kind of mentor to the leadership team. And it's kind of like that, you know, iron sharpening iron. And the role, I think, has kept us rooted and focused on what is important, despite the many distractions and pressures that we've had over the last 5 years. And I think we have and continue to grow, not by power, not by might, but by my spirit, says God. So what can we learn from Deborah's leadership in this particular story? It says that Deborah would judge from a position of isolation, sitting under a palm tree in the hill country of Ephraim. And the Gospels also depict Jesus as having a regular rhythm of withdrawing from crowds, and even the disciples to seek time alone with God. So this is life. She led life at a sacred pace. When we were listening to the Wildfire Conference, which I think I mentioned last week, it was commented on that after 9/11 in America, the church did some fantastic work, but it was noticeable that about 18 months later, there was a fallout in leadership, that people sort of after that crisis burnt out. And we should be wary of this for our leaders. You know, after the last few months of crisis with COVID, I don't think kind of burnout is part of God's plan, but we are called to lead our lives with God at a sacred pace, and that's challenging at times. In a short thought Dr. Kate Middleton gave from the Vineyard Church, she talked recently on how to avoid burnout, and one of her practical tips was that we should be prioritising time out for things that refresh us, not kind of squeezing it in at the end, but actually prioritising it in how we plan our week. And she sort of had that with biking. And I have found that recently with swimming, some wild swimming. And after a few years of being slightly illegitimately part of the Herefordshire Wild Swimming Facebook group, I've finally kind of found a group who want to go. And we've booked in a time each week, which I prioritise, and we go and swim in a river. And even the drive over is wonderfully peaceful. We can't share lifts at the moment. And we have a dip in the river and it's stunning. And we've even got a T-shirt. So these things are kind of booked in advance. Priority is done a part of the week. And after I've done that, I feel so refreshed. And over lockdown, I have been dipping in gently and slowly to a book by Esther Duval called Lost in Wonder. It's such a rich book that you can't really read it quickly. And she draws on and talks about the monastic traditions in the book. She talks about the architectural image of a cloisters in a monastery or church. And that cloisters is the heart of monastic life. And kind of physically, the cloisters are a square of kind of vaulted passageways which join the different buildings which are necessary for the daily needs of monastic life. So with its rhythm of body, mind and spirit, work, study and prayer. And these cloisters enclose a garden in which would stand a fountain or a well. So right in the middle was a green oasis of safety, simplicity and purity, open to the heavens and funneling daylight into the heart of the monastery. And she sees that as a kind of picture of how we should be. She says it's vital to see the cloister space in your own self as the pivot around which daily life revolves, the rock or anchor which holds it firmly grounded. She talks about the audacity of a life that puts uncluttered space, emptiness at its heart. So what does it look like for me? What does it look like for us to withdraw to seek God's plans and purposes? How do we maintain that uncluttered, abundant place of stillness at the centre of our hearts? And it seems that this is what made Deborah such a confident and strong leader that she judged from a place of stillness. The second bit that I draw out from her leadership is this kind of confidence. She hears God confidently and gives clear directions. She is so sure in how she hears from God that in verse 6 she says, "It has become clear that God, the God of Israel, commands you." She hears the word of the Lord and then speaks it out with confidence. This is in the face of what might seem to be insurmountable obstacles. The Israelites have been oppressed for 20 years. King Jabin has an elite, well-equipped army of 900 iron chariots. And yet she is confident. Just as a little by note, during lockdown with the children, we've been following the Oak Academy online history lessons and studying 20th century conflict, which has kind of filled in rather a lot of gaps in my history knowledge. And isn't it amazing that, well, I found out that one of the reasons we won World War One, even though the German trenches we found out were far superior and they were better equipped, was the outbreak of Spanish flu. You know, could that be God intervening? In any way, in this story, there was a huge obstacle in front of the Israelites, but Deborah speaks in absolute in absolute confidence. And in contrast, Barak seemed to lack confidence. He looked at the challenge and thought, I'm not doing that. And it's not, I don't think he was weak. He was commander of the army, but he saw an undefeatable force and reacted in fear. When a leader speaks with confidence, it inspires confidence, doesn't it? She doesn't just talk the talk, she walks it, and she instilled confidence by her actions. So why was she confident? Her confidence was in God. In verse 14, she says, "This is the day that the Lord has given Sisera into your hands." So that is what makes the difference. Deborah's confidence wasn't in Barak's abilities or in her own commitment. Her confidence was in God and in his power. And her song in chapter 5 gives all credit to him. So what about us? Do we get confidence from our bank balances? Do we get confidence from our fitness levels, the type of car we drive, our job title, people? I studied law because one of my teachers at the Chase thought it would be a good idea. And I didn't know a huge amount about it, but relished the opportunity, pursued studies abroad, took on the challenge of training to be a barrister, amazingly got through to tenancy in chambers. And when I decided to leave, I spent 11 months volunteering for organisations working with women involved in prostitution. That may sound all do-goody, but it was actually quite hard. As a volunteer, you don't have the same kudos as a paid worker. I'd left the suit behind, the high heels behind, and it was pretty hard at times. And then after that 11 months, I started working at HTB, Holy Trinity Brompton. And a week after I started, I found out that I was pregnant with Ava. And so started a kind of 10-year period with babies and preschool children up until September last year when Thea went to school, with some kind of part-time work in between. And although I seem to have gone back to that preschool period during lockdown, so it's not quite finished yet, there are huge joys of young children, but it is also quite hard in a number of ways. The lost identity in paid work, the routine nature of the days, nappy changing, making dinner, clearing up from dinner, wiping bottoms, dealing with tantrums. It's quite challenging. And I think a lot of women find that they can lose confidence in that period, which is why I was always so pleased that churches like ours offer havens like playgroups to pour love into parents at a really vulnerable time. Steve Furtick has talked about times where God allows you to lose false confidence to then teach you where you can find true confidence. He talks about crucifying false confidence. And I wonder whether some of the lessons learnt during that ongoing period are in that. Not being defined by my position, not being defined by earning a salary, not being defined by a job or a qualification, but being defined by a God who says who I am, and living in partnership with him. Paul says in Philippians 3, verse 4, "We put no confidence in human effort, though I could have ultimate confidence in my own effort if anyone could." And he lists all these advantages that he had. He says, "I once thought these things were valuable, but now I consider them worthless because of what Christ has done. Yes, everything else is worthless compared to the infinite value of knowing Christ my Lord. For his sake, I have discarded everything else, counting it all as garbage, so that I could gain Christ and become one with him. Deborah's confidence was not in her abilities or position, it was in God. What is interesting that it is not Deborah who is listed in Hebrews 11 as a great hero of faith, but Barak. So God chooses Barak to mention in Hebrews, who in our story lacked confidence. So it's a kind of encouragement for all of us who feel we lack confidence sometimes, that we can, through that, despite that, be heroes of faith. The next thing I wanted to draw out is Deborah's sensitivity to others, the kind of mentoring that she does. It's another kind of leadership quality that is so apparent in the story. She's her ability to draw alongside others and mentor. When Barak does not want to go by himself, Deborah doesn't kind of hesitate. She says, "I'll go with you." And we've been watching this series on Michael Jordan, the basketball player, on Netflix, which is really interesting. He was a leader in his sport, and obviously not a perfect person, but he said, "I never asked people to do something that I wasn't willing to do or already doing myself." And I think mentoring is something that we should be prepared to do at all levels of leadership, whether that be in life group, in youth, children's ministry. The ability to come alongside someone and intentionally walk with them, instilling confidence. So who has God placed in our lives that we should be intentional about mentoring? The next thing that I wanted to draw out is this element of her, Deborah, holding on to God's plans even when others are reluctant to follow. She's kind of obedient despite the circumstances and despite other people's reluctance. Another kind of Michael Jordan quote on leadership, where he says, "When you stand up, people can take shots at you. It comes at a cost. You're not popular." And it is interesting that in contrast to Barak, who is not willing to step out on his own, Deborah sort of says, it's kind of like an Esther-type point. If you do not step up, then others will. She says to Barak, "Of course I'll go with you, but understand that with an attitude like that, there'll be no glory in it for you. God will use a woman's hand to take care of Sisera." So we're asked to trust and obey. And when we don't, we miss out. We miss out on the peace that comes in walking in God's ways. And the kind of last thing I wanted to mention was her attitude of thankfulness. The whole of chapter 5 is taken up with a song she writes, giving thanks to God. And it's quite a detailed blow-by-blow account of the battle. Tim, I wonder whether there's any ideas for, you know, songwriting for you there. But she's kind of like the leper healed by Jesus, who comes back and says, "Thank you." And it's another demonstration of her relationship with God, that trust, obedience, thankfulness, knowing that she depends on God for everything. And she's dependent on a father who loves her and expresses that in every action. So how can we apply all of this to our lives? I think there's a number of points I'd draw out. Don't rule yourself out of leadership because of circumstances, not by power, not by might, but by my spirit. Life at a sacred place. Are you prioritising rhythms that set at the heart of your life an uncluttered, abundant place of stillness? Rest in God. In what are you placing your confidence? Are you walking the talk? If you don't feel confident, don't worry. God takes our imperfections and uses them. Barak is mentioned as a hero of faith in Hebrews, despite his lack of confidence. And perhaps today is an opportunity to move away from either kind of self-reliance, or maybe it's a chance to move away from a focus, you know, that perhaps we have on a lack of confidence. And that's sort of essentially concentrating on ourselves. Could we take our eyes off ourselves and our lack of confidence and place them on a God through whom nothing is impossible? Is there someone God is calling you to come alongside and mentor? Is there a challenge before you, a relationship or a circumstance that seems impossible? We can remember that in God, nothing is impossible. So let's take our eyes off the 900 iron chariots and focus on a God who can send a rainstorm. Let's pray together as I end. Father, thank you for the wonderful story of Deborah, such an inspiring leader in her life, rooted wholeheartedly in you and your purposes. Where we are lacking confidence today, may we place those areas in your hands, take the focus off ourselves and focus instead on a Father who loves us and will take our imperfections and use them in glorious ways. Would you help us to listen to your voice and be obedient to it? Help us to walk the walk and not just talk it. Would you highlight to each of us individuals who we can come alongside and mentor, use us to grow future leaders and encourage each other in the community? Help us to live lives rooted in a counter-cultural way, prioritising rhythms that set at the heart of our lives an uncluttered, abundant place of stillness that shouts of you and kingdom reality. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.